Call the Committee of Health and Human Services Finance to order. There being a quorum, Representative Bulmer will take you first, 1445. Representative Bulmer moves 1445 before the committee. Representative Considine.
I'll move the minutes.
Representative Considine moves the minutes for March 22nd. All those in favor?
Aye.
Approved.
Aye.
No.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Bulmer. I see you have a testifier. Please commence with the representation of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Would you like me to move the bill?
It's already moved.
Oh, it's moved. I'm sorry. So, House File 1455 proposes to expand and improve our consumer-directed community supports program so Minnesotans with disabilities can meet their housing and employment goals. Currently, 5,000 individuals on our waiver programs are utilizing the CDCS. Those individuals receive an annual budget, develop a support plan approved by the counties, are held accountable by working with the fiscal support entity, but have greater flexibility in developing their customized services and supports. Individuals on CDCS express a high level of satisfaction with their services. However, there are some barriers that exist in the program that create some disincentives for individuals considering using CDCS. House File 1445 will address those disincentives so more Minnesotans can benefit from having greater control over the resources available to them. So testifying today in support of House File 1445 to explain the changes and answer any questions is Steve Larson with the ARC.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota. And as Representative Bulmer introduced the bill, consumer-directed community supports is one of the more innovative programs that we have in services and supports for persons with disabilities. Individuals receive an annual budget. They work out a plan with the county. They learn how they're going to be held accountable working with the fiscal support entity, but then have greater flexibility on how they can plan and utilize their services. Some of the barriers that we're trying to address are when individuals reach 21, they've had a hard time getting additional resources in order to meet their employment and housing goals, and so this bill will address that and expand the opportunities for individuals with disabilities. The Office of the Legislative Auditor reinforced the need to do this as it cited Minnesota's low employment rate in integrated settings for persons with disabilities, as well as our need to increase integrated housing opportunities for persons with disabilities. Just quickly, there's three sections in the bill. The first section would address the need for individuals to get out of institutions such as Anoka and St. Peter. And if they're unable to reach their housing goals using some traditional or more formal services, this would give them the flexibility of using consumer-directed community supports with some additional resources added there. The second section expands the opportunity for individuals to seek an exception to the current budgeting process so that if in their person-centered plan they have individualized goals for employment or housing, they would be able to receive a budget exception to attain those goals. And then finally, we need to have a long-term fix to the budget methodology process, and this would implement the steps that are necessary over the next 2 or 3 years to develop a new budget methodology. We think that instead of having 5,000 people on consumer-directed community supports, we should have 10, 15, or 20,000 individuals that are controlling their resources, getting the supports they need to make wise decisions, but then having much more flexibility on how those services and supports are provided. In addition, just finally, this is also one of the solutions that we need for our direct support professional workforce crisis, because if we're able to use innovative ways of supporting people with disability, we can use the more formal supports for other individuals that can't take advantage of this particular program. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Hearing none, we will go to member questions. Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. I thought you were just stretching your fingers, Representative Considine.
Well, thank you. I've done that and been called on. So, appreciate the checking. Representative Wilmer, they just handed out the fiscal note. I haven't had a chance to look at it in depth. There's a $325,000 price tag. Could you just break down where that's going? And then I noticed there's nothing further. Could you break that down for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Considine. I'll let my testifier answer that question.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, the fiscal note we just received here shortly a while ago, too, it's actually down from several million dollars last biennium, so we're glad that it's minimal compared to that. But this would, I think, the fiscal note is primarily some of the administrative processes that need to be put in place to develop the exceptions process that I referenced. There also would be some administrative costs in developing the new budget methodology, which is an extensive effort. So those would be some of the primary things that the department, I'm sure, could come down and provide further detail if necessary.
Follow-up, Representative Considine.
Oh, thank you. So, but you're not anticipating any ongoing costs with it?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, not that I can see here, the money that's being spent on the individuals is already in the waiver budgets. It's already there. So this is mainly the administrative cost to tune it up and get it going in the direction that the bill tries to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Lohmer, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and thanks for your support.
With that, House File 1445 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Omnibus Bill, Finance Bill. Next up is Representative Baker, House File 1938. And I will move House File 1938 before the committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker. I do see a number of amendments in the jacket. Give you a second to settle yourself and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, as I just explained briefly, we do accept both amendments. One is a very small technical fix. The one that's a little bit larger, let me see if I get the number on it here for you. The A2 amendment is actually takes care of the financial or the funding mechanism of the bill that we stripped out of the first reform committee hearing a little bit more. This is a very important component. There is no controversy on it. The department needs this in here to make this bill work, but we would accept both amendments. If you could take them both at the same time, that would be great.
Members, I'll move the A2 amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Hearing on all in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Next, I'll move the A17-0243 amendment. Representative Baker, do you want to just briefly give us a synopsis on this one again, please?
Mr. Chair, it looks like just a very small correction on line 1.8 and 1.9. I'm going to have to have the department if there's a correction to the if it changes at all, but I was just told it was only a technical issue only, so
I believe this is coming from the revisor's office to correct a cross-reference that was overseen. Members, with that, any discussion to the A17-0243 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure it's fine, but you know, since what it's doing is including a couple more clauses here. So the paragraph is, when a chemical dependency treatment provider licensed under these Minnesota rules agrees to meet the applicable requirements under a certain section, and then the clauses that describe what they're agreeing to meet is being changed. And so I guess I I mean, it's technical in a sense, but it must be making some kind of substantive change. I'd like a little bit more of an explanation, maybe from staff, if we could.
Ms. Sunderman, if you could explain the amendment, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, this is it is a technical change because in the bill we're adding clauses to that section. So we've got several clauses added, and the numbering has just changed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. The discussion of the A17-0243. Hearing none, all those in favor of adoption of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Baker, to House Bill 1938 as adopted.
Thank you,
amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House Bill 1938 is a reform bill that the department has been working on for a couple of years now. It was 2012 legislative folks mandated the group to start looking at how do we treat addiction and the substance abuse differently in Minnesota. This reform bill does a lot to get us lined up with the federal waivers that is important for us to be a part of. We can do a better job in Minnesota with things like longer wait times for treatment when folks are looking for a place to detox. We need to provide wider ranges of service for individuals to have more beds. We just need a better system that actually we're realizing is a more of a holistic approach to how we deal with folks fighting this horrible disease. I'm going to make it a little brief, so I'm just going to think, just let it over to my testifier, and I'll just close with a couple comments at the end, Mr. Chair. So I think Lane will make some good comments on this, so thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and present your testimony. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, it's nice to see a lot of you again. My name is Lane Omer. I'm the CEO of New Beginnings. We are a provider of chemical dependency and mental health services in rural Minnesota. And on behalf of MARCH, our Industry Trade Association, I'm very excited to continue to support this bill. So like Representative Baker said, DHS, counties, providers, many other stakeholders have been working on this reform package for 5 years. It's time to implement these long overdue reforms. These reforms will help reverse the alarming growth in overdose deaths by improving our system. It's also going to bring a solution to the IND exclusion, which many of you are well aware of. Without this reform, there is no waiver, and there is no solution. And finally, please do not forget Representative Baker's other critically important bill, House File 872, because programs are hanging on by a thread. And without a rate increase, it's going to be very hard for programs to keep their doors open over the next few years. If we can't keep our doors open, everybody loses. There won't be programs to implement these reforms. People will go untreated. And as study after study has shown, untreated people will be a much larger financial burden to the state. So this is smart reform, and the rate increase is a smart investment for Minnesota. Thank you for your time and your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close public comment. And two members, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I actually spent St. Patrick's Day in court, but for not reasons some of you think. And and got to meet with some of our judicial people, and it was about this was one of the main issues they talked about, and the role that this plays, and when there are delays, how there's a momentum people acquire towards getting sober, getting cleaned up. And when there's a delay or there's a stop, how detrimental that can be on them following through. And so programs like this, I got to see firsthand how important it was, and I just want to thank you for what you're doing.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker, congratulations, because you have one of the few bills that seems to save money and do good things at the same time, and that is a rare combination around here. And so we just got the fiscal note, so I haven't had a chance to really read it, but it shows over the biennium a savings of biennial total, $446,000. So I just wonder if maybe just for a couple of minutes you or your testifier could kind of explain how it's doing that. Because I know there's more of a story there, and I could read this whole fiscal note, but since here we are, I think it would be a good opportunity to, because I think that there probably are a lot of things where we could do better, actually, with less money if we aligned ourselves a bit better.
Representative Baker. Mr. Chair and Representative Levy, thank you for that. I will bring down our true expert and honestly champion on this bill. She has been working for this for the last 2-3 years just on this, a lot of other things, but this is her baby, and I think that she can explain it as best as anybody, so thank you for that.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, so this, what you're seeing reflected in the fiscal note is truly the fact that if we make investments in less costly upstream interventions, we see savings down the line. So by investing in peer recovery supports and increasing capacity in the workforce to have, you know, that kind of direct experience with people with lived experience, we expect people to maintain their sobriety longer and have less episodic interactions with treatment. By investments in detox, we expect less interactions with detox and less costly readmissions into treatment. And then, of course, with direct access, as was mentioned, we expect that once people have the ability to really get into treatment, when they're ready to get into treatment, that those linkages to care will have an impact that will result in, again, less costly interventions down the line. And really, people will maintain their recovery and therefore decrease cost on the system.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling?
Thank you. That's great. Great to hear. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We all agree on trying to do the smart thing early and prevent relapse. But I do see in the out years that we actually do get into fiscal year 2021. This is a phased process. We do end up with about $8 million of additional costs, and most of it is in the medically monitored withdrawal management. And that I'm not familiar with what that is, and if you could describe what this new service is it going to be long-term for people who are in recovery? Is this just for a certain period after success? Could you give us a little idea of what we're committing to in the long term?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the medically managed and the clinically managed withdrawal management, those are new levels and new services which were operationalized through licensing last year by the legislature, but that adds really two new services which are currently referred to as detox. So these are the services that individuals engage with when they're initially, you know, coming in to stabilize themselves for recovery. So what you're seeing reflected in the fiscal note, of course, right now the counties pay the full share for detox, and therefore we've seen less availability of services because of the cost of providing those services. This creates new levels of detox, and what you're seeing in the fiscal note is the state share that will be picked up from those Medicaid benefits.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have been trying for a long time to get Medicaid coverage of some of those services, and I'm glad it's here. I just wasn't familiar with the term.
Any other questions? Your bill, Representative Baker, as amended.
Again, this is a really big day for treating folks with this horrible disease. I really want to thank Ms. Wilson for her work on this. I want to really thank the chair of this committee and the whole committee to include this hopefully in the omnibus bill. This is a new day and I think a new future for helping people with disease. So thank you again, Mr. Chair.
With that, House File 1938 as amended is held laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance omnibus bill. Representative Chair Dean. House File 1804. Excuse me. Chair Dean moves House File 1730 before the committee. As he makes his way to the testifier's table, I understand that you have an author's amendment, Chair Dean.
Yep.
Mr. Chair and members, I move House File 1730 be held over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. I'd also like to move the A2 amendment, which is a technical amendment worked out between the providers and the Department of Health, which deals primarily with the physical environment and licensing standards. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but would like to adopt A2 immediately.
Chair Dean moves the A2-2 author's amendment. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify to the bill?
No.
Seeing none, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you know I'm a supporter of this legislation, and as I look at the amendment, it does ask that we seek a federal waiver. And yesterday we passed legislation that would put some limitations and boundaries on waivers and their timing. So I know this is an important amendment, but it's an important piece of legislation, and I just want to flag for you that if we pass that amendment from yesterday, we might slow this process down.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the H1730A2-2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The H1730A2-2 amendment is adopted.
Yes.
To your bill, Chair Dean, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Many of you heard this in the Policy Committee. It's a kind of an exciting opportunity that I think we can look at that provides better care, will alleviate some of the stress on our hospital intensive care units, and also provide better care to kids with disabilities that need to get reintegrated and back home. And this bill was brought to me by Ms. Wingert from Pediatric Home Services. During the session, it was kind of a late arrival, but it was one that I think a lot of us are glad that she brought the idea forward, and we had some really good bipartisan support on this bill. So excited to bring this forward, hopefully to get it underneath the door and in time for the omnibus bill. So I'll let Ms. Wingert explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and present us with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Susan Wingert. I own a small company called Pediatric Home Service. We take care of medically complex children in the home. House File 1730 is here to do three things. It's to provide a daycare center for medically complex children, to meet the needs first of the family and the child, secondly to the employee nurse, and finally to the community. This particular idea simply allows us to take children from the hospital into an environment that is not exclusively a home environment. It provides the same safety factors, and it provides the same medical care. It just does it at a much more reasonable cost. I'll be happy to entertain any questions about how that happens if you need to.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and go to member questions for the testifier or the author of the bill. Representative Considine.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you provide respite services?
No, sir. This is a Representative Considine, all we do in this particular case is to provide daycare on a regular basis.
Any other questions? Chair Dean, to your bill as amended.
Appreciate your support.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
With that, House File 1730 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill.
Representative Albright moves House File 1804 be held over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. There are no amendments or fiscal note in the packet. Representative Albright to 1804.
Thank you, Chair Dean. As those of you on the Health and Human Services Policy Committee heard me last week, this bill aims to help strengthen a very important mental health service we have available here in Minnesota. mental health crisis residential services. When an individual is experiencing a mental health crisis and feels they need a safe place where they can stay temporarily to cope with the crisis, mental health crisis residential services are available throughout Minnesota. The service provides individuals access to mental health services in a facility where they can stay for a few days until their mental health crisis is under control. Currently, individuals and providers have to go through a lengthy paperwork process to access state reimbursement for this mental health crisis service. However, because this service is meant to be temporary, with an average stay of between 3 and 5 days, the individuals assessing this service often haven't completed the lengthy paperwork process that generally involves back and forth communications with the county by the time that they've completed their stay in the provider's mental health crisis program. As a result, the provider doesn't get reimbursed for providing the service. This bill minimizes the lengthy paperwork process that individuals and providers have to go through to access reimbursement for the service, and in so doing, will allow individuals and providers to focus on the most important task at hand, supporting the individual to work through their mental health crisis, instead of having to focus on complicated and time-consuming eligibility paperwork. Mr. Chair and members, I have Jeff Bradley with me to help explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bradley. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair, Dean, and committee members, my name is Jeff Bradley, and I'm the president of Tribe Behavioral Network, and I'm here representing the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. As you've already heard and from previous testimony, this bill is related to mental health crisis residential services. When a client of ours comes in to receive service, the staff immediately begin providing that service and also begin working with them to fill out the paperwork regarding group residential housing. The extensive and detailed questions involving bank account information and other items that the individual is generally in the midst of an acute mental health crisis. However, our staff work as best they can to support the individual and send it to the county for processing. We're all aware of the significant workload that many of our county workers face, and therefore it can sometimes be weeks before the county gets back to the service provider with the status of the eligibility and verification process. And often the follow-up communication is the county involving a request for further information such as more bank statements or income verification documents. In other settings where GRH is used, the person is generally accessing it for a prolonged period of time, and so that extended time of weeks may not be a large deal, but as has been mentioned, the average stay in a crisis residential setting is 3 to 5 days. So by the time the provider hears back from the county about additional documentation, the individual has generally long since completed their stay and is no longer available. At that point, the provider has the choice to either use some limited staff time to try to track down that individual and the needed paperwork, or forego the payment for the mental health crisis residential services. To put it simply, we have a situation today where, in some instances, the provider has provided the mental health crisis residential service and they're denied payment, not because the individual is determined to be ineligible, but because the lengthy and administratively burdensome verification process doesn't align with the temporary structure of this program. What this bill would do is, if someone is receiving medical assistance and it is assumed they're eligible for the GRH payment for mental health crisis residential services, by targeting this presumptive eligibility for GRH funds to those accessing MA and mental health crisis residential services, we believe we're effectively targeting the funds to low-income Minnesotans working to cope with a serious mental illness, which is one of the purposes of GRH. This streamlining change of presumptive eligibility that is proposed in this bill will help increase access to this critical mental health residential service and allow providers and the individuals accessing the service to focus exclusively on addressing their mental health crisis at hand. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? We will close off public testimony. Member questions? Seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Albright.
I'd like to thank Mr. Representative Fisher for co-authoring the bill. It shows bipartisan support on the behalf of those that are most needed of these services.
All right. With that, House File 1804 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Albright 2115. Representative Albright moves House File 2115 be laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Albright, there are no amendments or fiscal note in the packet. Representative Albright to 2115.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2115, as many of us discussed in policy, is all about improving patient outcomes through data mining and using that to improve the outcomes for our patients. As we all know, the quality of care provided in Minnesota is generally very good, and we pride ourselves on it. And generally, our providers are efficient as well. But as with anything in life, improvements can be made. Thankfully, steps have already been taken to identify the areas for further quality improvements, and we have providers in our state that have successfully taken those steps to make such improvements in patient outcomes. It is from these efforts that this bill is derived, to systematically adopt such reforms across Medicaid. First, in 2015, the Minnesota Department of Health issued a report to help identify areas for improvement. Using the Minnesota All Payers Claims Database and 2012 data for 4.3 million insured Minnesotans, the analysis found that Minnesotans experienced an estimated 1.3 million potentially avoidable health care events, accounting for nearly $1.9 billion, or 4.8%, of total health care spending in the state that year. While not all of these events are actually avoidable, the report identifies areas where we can look to take steps to improve and coordinate patient care and reduce costs, potentially avoiding admissions, readmissions, and emergency department visits. Second, our own hospitals in Minnesota have taken steps to take a look at the rates of potentially avoidable hospital readmissions. And they won the 2014 National Quality Forum Patient Safety and Quality Award for their Reducing Avoidable Readmissions Effectively campaign, otherwise known as RARE. Over a two-year period, the participating 82 Minnesota hospitals prevented over 5,400 potentially avoidable readmissions, helping patients stay out of the hospitals and save millions of dollars. This bill draws from what we've learned from both the Minnesota DOH report and the RARE campaign to help reward value over volume and quality over quantity for our Minnesota Medicaid beneficiaries and taxpayers. And importantly, the bill seeks to do this without telling providers how to improve patient care. We just focus on and reward better patient outcomes. And let providers continue to do the great work that they do, innovating and figuring out how to achieve these important goals. I do have a testifier with me if there are any questions pertinent to the technical aspects of the bill. But I stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I also see that there is an amendment that you had passed out that did not make deadline. We can discuss that if you'd like, whatever your choice, but we can't act on the amendment because it didn't make deadline.
I will preclude consideration of it at this time, and we'll take it up later.
All right. Okay. I do see that we have one gentleman that signed up to testify on the bill, Mr. Sonneborn. Please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Sonneborn. I am the Vice President of Health Information and Analytics for the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I'm speaking on behalf of 142 hospitals and health systems we represent. We are opposed to this bill. There's already a quality reporting and incentive system in place in Minnesota for hospitals known as the Statewide Quality Reporting and Measurement System, or SQRMS. And SQRMS has evolved over the years to align with federal reporting requirements through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. The CMS and SQIMS measures already include measures of readmissions and complications. The measures in this described in this bill are not aligned with either CMS or SQIMS, so this would add significant burden and confusion for hospitals as well as consumers. We have other concerns as well. This is based on Medicaid only. Many hospitals will not have sufficient Medicaid volume in order for the state to do statistically reliable analysis of their performance. In fact, our data show that 74% of Minnesota hospitals, that's over 100 of them, have less than 10 preventable Medicaid readmissions in a year. There are simply not enough cases for most hospitals to make this a fair measure for an incentive program. Also, this is perhaps 5 years too late. As the representative described, hospitals came together to address readmissions through the Reducing Avoidable Readmissions Effectively campaign, RARE. Using several different intervention strategies, we were able to collectively reduce the readmission rate by nearly 20% in 18 months. Since that time, we've been able to attain those improvements, but the reductions right now are far less dramatic. This bill won't achieve anywhere near the type of results that 3M talks about in other states like Maryland and Texas, because we've already achieved them without this bill. This would be, frankly, a waste of time and our resources. We're also uncertain of the impact on the Integrated Healthcare Partnerships, or IHPs, who are already incentivized to reduce avoidable costs. How would this affect their savings potential? This seems like an unnecessary carve-out of what they're already trying to do. Finally, we're also concerned that the language in this bill is vendor-driven. A likely outcome of its passage would be that hospitals would have to purchase proprietary software to analyze their data. In addition to the millions of dollars that hospitals would spend on the software, that would pale in comparison to the cost of redirected staff time of nurses, physicians, and quality improvement professionals to address their performance results, over and above what's currently required for SQIRMS, CMS, and other measurement burdens. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sonneborn. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none, we'll close off the testimony and open it up to member questions. The first question is from Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it piqued my interest when you mentioned a company, specifically 3M, and so I guess I was looking for a little bit more background on who has this kind of reporting software, and I guess you sort of answered my question through your testimony that it sounds like they're the only ones that would have the reporting software available, or are there other vendors that do?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I have testified that from through the entity in question that is happy to explain that.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. And my name is Jerry Tracy, and I work for 3M Health Information Systems. And I run something called the State Initiatives Program. So that means we work with state Medicaid agencies all over the country. And I'd like to respond. First, I'd like to respond to some of the things that Mark Sonneborn said. First of all, my general statement is that 3MHIS has worked and has great respect for the work that's already happening in this state. We work with DHS. We work with the Minnesota Hospital Association very closely on that excellent RARE program that Mark was just talking about. We work with the Blue Cross organization, and we work with the Minnesota Department of Health. This bill is not about, if you will, the disparaging or in any way discounting the excellent work that's certainly happening. What this bill is about, and I would submit that Minnesota is not doing enough of this. I would also submit that pretty much most states in the country are not doing enough of this. It is about reducing healthcare waste, okay? By reducing potentially preventable events, in this case, readmissions, complications. The experience this bill basically draws from, as Representative Albright said, the experience of what's happened in Minnesota, but it also draws on the experience of about 12 or 13 other states. I'll use a few examples. In Maryland, using a program very, very similar to this, after 2 years, they reduced potentially preventable complications by 20% and saved the state $105 million. By year five, this program was reducing potentially preventable complications, which is one of the two measures talked about here, by 50%, and 50% reduction in preventable complications, and the savings have now are approaching $200 million. This, everything I'm talking about with this study has been written up in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's been written up in Health Affairs. This is not just, if you will, 3M talking. The other point I do want to make about the, you know, if you will, whether this is a, to be blunt about it, a vendor bill or not, it's not. Yes, 3M works with states all over the country, but in all these situations, and in this bill proposed, there's nothing in this bill that forces DHS to use 3M tools. If DHS wants to reduce complications, there are several private vendors out there that could use what the federal government's using. They could use 3M stuff. With readmissions and MHA chose to use the 3M readmissions and they're a very successful real program, but DHS would be free to use a number of readmissions measures out there. In the states where 3M does this kind of work, what happens is usually, sure, a number of 3M tools get used. And we think that's good. We think our tools are great. We'd like everybody to use them. But there's no state, Texas, New York, Maryland, Illinois, the 10 or 11 other states that are doing this, where they're just using 3M tools and the hospitals are forced to buy them. What usually happens, the hospitals may choose to buy those tools. There's nothing in this bill that would require the hospitals to buy anything from 3M. They might choose to, but there's nothing in there that requires that. So certainly I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tracy. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's still not clear to me what else is out there and available and what would happen if the hospitals didn't buy 3M, the 3M-specific tools. Actually, for Mr. Sonneborn, I'm kind of interested in how this intersects with SQIRM, or would this require twice the reporting, twice the analysis, or?
Thank you, Mr.
Sonneborn.
I don't know if I would call it twice, but it would be more. It is duplicative. There is two separate readmission, two separate complication measures that this would require.
Mr. Chair, one more question. And does this get to some of the issues that we see with the medical assistance population in terms of what are the drivers of readmission, that very often they're not, you know, discharged to a necessarily safe place, and we there are drivers outside the hospital system that lead to readmission. And so how do you analyze that now, and how would this change that?
Mr. Sonneborn?
Mr. Chair and committee, right now it's a challenge. We look at it in a systematic way. It isn't all under the hospital's control. When they are discharged from the hospital, they are supposed to visit their primary care physician within a small number of days, and if that doesn't happen, their risk of readmission increases a lot, and we don't have that under our control. But we try to follow up and coordinate care to make sure that primary care visit happens, and then the readmission risk goes down. So this is something we work. It isn't just under our control, and we work very hard with our partners to coordinate care to help the patient.
Thank you. And Mr. Sonneborn, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you? I'm just wondering, one of the things that we really have, that we pay close attention to in this committee and other committees, but DHS and Department of Health does a great deal of contracting with private vendors for reports and for a lot of the technical information that we rely upon. And one of the things that we really try to be very clear on is whether they're doing a request for proposal or if we're bidding something out, that we don't have proprietary language in our bills. And can you talk a little bit about why you characterize this as proprietary towards 3M and just where in the bill that is? Because I'm having a difficulty finding that.
Sure. Whether 3M is chosen or some other vendor, there probably will be some form of proprietary software. It doesn't have to be. But usually in other states that I'm aware this has happened, it has. 3M has been chosen. The phrase potentially avoidable is something that's actually part of their software. It's called potentially preventable events. And so that sort of, that language and the way it's written sort of moves you towards thinking that it's a, that 3M would be chosen, but it isn't in the bill that 3M would be chosen, but it's written in a way that it would be likely.
Mr. Sonneborn, wouldn't it make sense that lots of vendors would try to analyze payment data to discover potentially avoidable events or days?
Yes.
And Mr. Sonneborn, the things that they're asking to report on, and I realize that hospitals report on just about everything under the sun, and they report on the reports, and then they have to report that, and I understand that you're heavily regulated and report a lot of information for community measurement for lots of other places. We make you do that stuff. But the things that that the bill is saying that you should check on and report, I agree with you, are things that probably are already being analyzed, because I've seen reports under these basic titles on baskets that we look at for trying to stop doing stuff that hurts people or waste money. So I'm just trying to figure out which portions of these you would have a problem with, or I don't really agree with you that this looks proprietary. I think that we would direct the commissioner to do an RFP in a non-proprietary manner, and I would trust that the commissioner would be able to do that within her purview in order to do that in such a way that it is not, that is not proprietary, because that's a big deal. Is there anything in there that we're asking for as you look at the bill that either you're not currently at least partially looking at or would seem odd or from left field to report on?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the hospital portion of this, these are all things that are currently being reported on through CMS. There's penalty programs for readmissions and for complications.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm pleased to hear and not surprised, because we've heard about this before, that lots of good things are already happening on this front and that 82 hospitals have already demonstrated measurable outcomes by doing things on their own initiative, which I assume has inspired other hospitals in our state to step forward too. And I'm concerned that we are piling on an unfunded mandate potentially to hospitals to do another set of reporting to another set by, additional software, or have analysts on their staff to try and see how these reports are going to be done, and without really understanding how this particular thing would be add a whole lot of value given all that's been going on. And it seems to me, if this approach had value, we could pilot it with a couple of hospitals who aren't in that 82 to see how their outcomes were compared to the rare. It's really typical that we do a lot of pilots. We've done, our integrated health plans have been mentioned. Those started out as pilots, and have been expanding across the state and have absolutely amazing outcomes in these areas and showing the cost savings that this has. And so I'm wondering, Representative Albright, if you thought about that in terms of could we approach this as seeing whether this is a tool that would be helpful with the hospitals that haven't stepped up and see what kind of results we get.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I think there's a misnomer about the understanding of what this bill is intended to do, and not to indict you for the question, but to suggest that this is a bill that actually provides information back to the hospitals. It is not about reporting. It is about encouraging the hospitals themselves to dig and to mine the data that is already collected by them in a way that maybe puts a different set of eyes on the data and provides it back to the hospitals in a way that they possibly haven't looked at before to improve the outcomes that they're already realizing. So there is no additional responsibility to report. The responsibility is actually to themselves to see what's in the data that they can do a better job at improving the outcomes for the patients they're serving. And my testifier, I think, probably also has some add-on.
Mr. Tracy.
May I respond to that also?
Yes, Mr. Tracy.
Yes, thanks. Representative Albright is exactly right. There's no additional data that the hospital will need to provide with this. There's no new reports the hospital will do. The way it's set up, and the way it's been set up in the 11 or so other states that have done this with hospitals, is the state does three things. The state, first of all, systematically identifies where the waste is in the state of Minnesota. And I would submit, DHS has not done that, but actually, Minnesota Department of Health has taken a good first crack at that. So in a way, what we're saying is the first step the state would need to do is identify and quantify all the waste in the system, not just say there's a bunch of preventable this or preventable that, but to quantify it the way the Minnesota Department of Health did in 2015. So that's number one. Number two, the state may create potentially preventable complications and readmission reports and give them to the hospitals. And those reports should be very carefully designed to make sure that hospitals are not penalized for what hospitals treat the sickest people. They're not penalized for that. Where the hospitals, special situations like rural hospitals, that all of those are dealt with. All of the stuff that Mark brings up. And those are very good points. Okay, those are very substantive points that he brings up. They have been dealt with in a bunch of other states. Texas has 370 hospitals, and they have a lot of really small hospitals. But this program was done successfully in Texas in a way that Texas is saving about $50 million a year, sustainable savings with potentially preventable readmissions, as is proposed here. Another $7 or $8 million a year for potentially preventable complications, as is proposed here, and all the hospitals have been involved. There are ways to do it. And again, there's nothing in here that says what Minnesota is doing is insufficient. All we would say, and if I may add, today where we're all watching what's going to happen in Congress. Whatever is going to happen in terms of Medicaid reform, whatever that means, or what comes out of the federal government, is going to be about improving efficiency. There is not going to be more money from the federal government on Medicaid. So we've got to get more efficient in every state. This is just a way to build on what you're doing, take it to a whole new level, and focus on waste. The third aspect, if I can mention, there's financial incentives also. And the financial incentives are not just zinging hospitals with penalties. They're a mixture, done right, of rewards and penalties to incentivize the hospitals to pay more attention to waste. Amongst all the other busy what many things hospitals have to do to pay even more attention to reducing waste. Maryland, which I just described, reducing complications by 50% in 5 years, put a very small amount of premium rates at risk, 0.5%. That was all that was put at risk. But that was enough to get the attention of the Johns Hopkins and all those other fine Maryland hospitals that they themselves established these programs. So,
thank you, Mr. Tracy. Representative Loeffler.
I do note that it does, you know, it isn't just about collecting data and helping hospitals do better. It's also about how we purchase and finance our payments to both hospitals and managed care organizations. And while the bill in its language does on the managed care outcomes program direct how DHS should set rates, it does say that they'll create or locate state norms, measure the expected managed care organization performance to state norms. They can have an adjustment that related to chronic illness burden of each patient's enrollees, and then they use it to adjust capitation rates. And chronic illness burden is not the only thing that influences outcomes. If you're a managed care organization that disproportionately has low-income, homeless, mentally ill drug users that come in Hennepin County compared to another part of the state, even though they may have the same profile, we know that an IV drug user, HIV positive person, is less compliant no matter how good the hospital is or the doctors than someone who isn't IV drug, an intravenous drug user. And so there's no, or someone who isn't who's homeless and doesn't have a place to store their medications and count on regular food and those sorts of things to have with their medications. And so the adjustments in the finance mechanism, I don't think really reflect the care burden in a way that we would want. And I think if we're going to, I'm not opposed to us getting good data to improve care of people. That we have done consistently, and we always are looking for new tools to do that. But to say in this bill that we're going to change our financing system for both hospitals and managed care organizations based on this is to be a little scary. And in the language on the hospitals, I do not see anything that says there will be adjustments or risk adjustment based into the hospital-based reimbursement portion of this. It is in the managed care portion. And so I think if we're going to look at this not just as an outcomes measurement, but as a total transformation of how we set rates, I think we really should have some modeling of it before we put it in a law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
I might apologize to Representative Loeffler on behalf of the amendment that we didn't discuss because it did not make deadline, but it sincerely addresses some of the most substantive concerns that you raised with regard to MCOs. And so, that being said, I think many of and innumerable, most of your fears could be allayed if we would have had that amendment in time to adopt onto the bill.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, and to the to Representative Albright, so if this isn't a vendor bill, who besides 3M is asking for it?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, as well as finance this biennium, I have always have undertaken a desire to find organizations and or mechanisms that would help us first and foremost to understand the beast, if you will, if I can use that term, in terms of how do we gain control over the numbers? How do we gain control over the payment structures? How do we understand how we can put the patient at the core of what it is that we are about in terms of healthcare in this state? And with that being said, it has been my desire to reach out to organizations to find out what they have available to them, whether it be to United Health, to 3M, to others that have at their disposal divisions, departments, and or specialty services within the organizations that do just that type of service. And so with that, I was intrigued by what the 3M organization brought to me, and we went about the process of putting that together in a bill fashion that would provide for an open architecture that was competitive in nature and provided those that would be interested in an RFP process to entertain a response to that. I hope that's helpful.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Albright. And I'm in no way questioning your motives for bringing the bill. I'm just wondering, you know, usually when we come forward with these kind of measures, you know, there's somebody is asking whether it's the hospitals. It's clearly in this case it's not the hospitals. And I kind of would like to hear from the MCOs. I don't know what their position on this is. I think it would be great if there was somebody here, because MCOs, of course, includes our HMOs and are also our county-based purchasing, I assume would be covered by the bill as well. So I would like to hear from them, but I do have some additional questions, too, as I'm trying to understand what this bill is doing. There were some questions about the squirms and the measures that are already in place, and I know that I recall that the chair has a bill that I think was brought kind of on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association, maybe others as well, that's actually streamlined some of these measures and tried to line us up with Medicare and make things a little easier in terms of outcome measures. And one of my questions is, how does this align with that?
And I believe that Mr. Tracy would be happy to respond to that question.
Mr. Tracy.
Yep. Thank you. With respect to these measures, the 3M version of the measures are being used in about 14 different states. These kinds of programs, which include federal measures, sometimes other proprietary, are being used in a whole bunch of states beyond that. CMS has their way of doing some of these programs. 3M works very closely with CMS, and we do all the hospital payment work for CMS, so we work very closely with them. We do differ with CMS about all-cause readmissions. They have an approach to all-cause readmissions, which only takes three of the medical conditions, does not deal with related, or excuse me, unrelated readmissions, and basically 3M has a different and more extensive measure. So the states are not yet lining up uniform behind everything that CMS is doing. There's a lot of state-by-state experimentation. There's a lot of state-by-state work. And certainly in other states where this has been proposed, sure, the hospitals, the plans, DHS would want to take a look at it. Absolutely. I think what you will find is once you take a look at it, this is a really good approach. This approach, and maybe I'm missing something about Minnesota, but this approach is really saving tens of millions of dollars by doing the right things in a whole bunch of states. And with all the good things happening in Minnesota, you might want to consider.
Representative Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you. You might be missing something about Minnesota. And I think that we need to get some more input into this, but I remain concerned that we have two different bills that may be going in opposite directions here in terms of adding measures or taking away measures, and are we streamlining, are we needing to add? I'm not really sure where we are and all of that, but there's also been mention of that the Department of Human Services could do an RFP. I don't see that in the bill, but I also didn't see a fiscal note for the bill, and it sounds like what's being asked here, although maybe not in the language, but sort of assumed, is that our departments, whether it's health or whether it's probably DHS in this case, since we're only talking here about medical assistance, they're going to be expected to do some kind of RFP process, and so I guess I'd really like to know, especially since we're a fiscal committee here, what's the state cost of this? are we getting a fiscal note on it, and what does the department think about their ability to do what's being required by this bill?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. Again, as I mentioned with the question from Representative Loeffler, we are striking the language that considers the MCOs, so that the managed care organizations should not be included going forward. Unfortunately, the amendment came to us late, and we were not able to add it on formally. It's based upon deadlines, and we understand that, but we're hopeful that that will remedy a number of your concerns, and I too recognize that in some cases we may be a cross current to the chair's a bill, but I think in any fashion, I think there's always an advantage of having a number of sets of eyes on the process. And a compliment to his bill, I think, would be this one, but I look forward to working with the chair closely. You know, breaking arms, breaking bread, whatever he wants to do over the matter to really, as I've said before, put the patient at the center of the focus for our Minnesota healthcare system.
Representative Lee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. Okay, so taking out the MCOs, that takes a whole lot of problems out of the bill. Thank you. Sorry, I didn't quite catch that when you were talking with Representative Loeffler, but the question still remains, though, about the RFP. If there's going to be an RFP process, somebody has to run that process. If it's hospitals, maybe it would be the Department of Health. I think we're still talking, though, about only Medicaid patients. And so I don't know which agency would be doing that, but I didn't see that in the bill, and I'm not seeing where the cost of doing that would be carried in the bill. And I would sure like to hear from those agencies, whichever one you think it's going to be, about whether this is something that they think they can do.
Mr. Tracy.
I can't speak for Minnesota, obviously, but in other states that have done work like the state agency, Medicaid agency, selects the measures, decides what measures are going to be used, designs the program. They do that. I have seen in some states them go through an RFP process to do that. In some states, they have not gone through an RFP process. They've used existing vendors. And by the way, just so we take
Mr.
that
Casey,
up.
Mr. Casey, let me just interrupt. I'm sorry. The bill does reference DHS and Commissioner in line 1.13. So I think it's pretty clear that that's the agency that we're talking about, although I would agree with you, Representative Liebling, that it would be better to have a paragraph that says that the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services shall, in consult with, extend an RFP. That would make it better.
So, Mr. Chair, then is there going to be a fiscal note? And you know, that plus with the amendment that will be coming, I don't know if that, you know, that is may change since we're now taking out the MCOs, which would clearly be under Human Services.
The fiscal note has been requested. We have not yet received it.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sanborn, kind of following up on this, what do you anticipate this will cost each hospital going forward?
Mr. Sanborn.
The cost, as has been mentioned, isn't in data reporting. The data's there. The cost is in software acquisition and in the time spent by the staffs having to interpret the results of the performance and then do the quality improvement on this, as well as what they're on top of what they're already doing with the other measures that they're, so it's additive. I don't know that I have a real estimate for you. I think it's in the millions of dollars when you add up for the state.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Give me a ballpark on what you you know think it will cost individual hospitals.
Of course, it would depend on the size of the hospital. The larger ones would have a larger cost, but it easily $200,000 a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sanborn.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hamilton. Halverson left. Okay. Hamilton, let's go to you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I see, thank you, Representative Albright. I see that we're addressing my concerns with the amendment, but I want to get it on record anyway. My concern was under subdivision 9, starting on lines 2.4. Talking about, here's my concern, having somebody completely unrelated between the doctor and the patient potentially making recommendations or overriding doctor's orders on how to treat that patient. I'm experiencing that in other areas, and it is extremely concerning. And so, again, I just want to state what my concern would be if language like this is in a bill to where we're interfering between the doctor and the patient relationship. If you'd like to comment on that, please.
May I respond? Mr. Tracy.
There's nothing in this bill that would have the Medicaid agency get in the middle of the doctor-patient relationship and arbitrate, oh, this is preventable, this is not preventable. That's not the way it works. In fact, just an autobiographical note, I'm a health care lawyer. I had a lot of experience with what's called utilization review in the 1990s, and you're exactly right, sir. That's, you don't want to be arbitrary, case by case. This one was preventable. The word potentially preventable, or potentially, look, the word potentially is key here. All this does is give hospitals information about their rates. It does not jump in and say, oh, that was a preventable admission, we're not going to pay for that. It does not do that. And none of the programs I've talked about in other states do that. It provides hospitals information about their rates, how they're doing compared to a state norm. What's the state norm? It's how all the other hospitals in Minnesota are doing on these specific potentially preventable readmissions and complications. Provides that information, actionable information that can be taken down right to an individual case level, and then the hospitals figure out how they can bring the rates down. It is up to the hospital to do that. That's, I'm really glad you raised that, because that's a very important point. And, well, that is not the way this is done for all kinds of reasons, and it would not be done in Minnesota. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Tracy. Representative Schultz, and then I think we're probably going to have to wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm a little confused. Mr. Tracy? You said that the hospitals would not be doing more reporting. So is it the DHS that will be buying the software and not the hospitals?
DHS would be buying whatever software chooses to buy. But by the way, if it's relevant here, DHS already licenses all the software we're talking about that 3M has. The 3M version of preventable, DHS already has that. And they get it for $0. They get it for free. That's 3M's business model. They've had this software for several years now. So they wouldn't have to buy any of the software. If they chose to use other non-3M software, if it's federal government, they would not have to buy it. They would be free probably. If they bought from another vendor, it would cost. So, you know, whatever cost those are. Mark's correct that there would be, and this says DHS, the hospitals, should be paying more attention to waste. That's the premise of the whole bill. Therefore, that's right. Mark's correct. And I don't think it's anywhere near $200,000 or anything resembling that, but he is correct. Hospitals would be needing to pay attention to this set of things even more, potentially preventable event complications and admissions, and DHS would also. So, I can't assess the staff costs or certainly the individual hospital costs. The cost of licensing software to the hospitals we're talking about is $10,000 to $25,000 a year. That's the cost of the software. What the hospitals would have to do to pay more attention to that, sure. But the state would have to decide that it's important to do this, that it's important for the hospitals to pay attention to waste in this way. It's important to DHS. It's all based on that.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the hospitals would need to purchase the software?
The hospitals would not have to purchase anything, including the software. The hospitals might want to purchase software
or they might want to do purchase services or do other things with other vendors, probably not to improve their complications and readmissions, right? They might want to do that. But no, nobody has to buy software to do this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this reporting, it's DHS that's looking for, through the data, using the already licensed software. And giving paper copies, possibly, to the hospitals with information they've collected and found and interpreted.
They would be distributing, that's right, they would be distributing potentially avoidable complication and potentially avoidable readmission reports to the hospitals on a regular basis. And it's usually obviously done electronically. And websites,
Mr. Chair, so in 2015 you mentioned that
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. That the Minnesota Department of Health has already conducted something similar in 2015. Did
Correct.
They use this software that they already have licensed?
Yes, they did.
And do we know how much that costs?
Mr. Tracy.
It did not cost them anything. The software did not cost Minnesota Department of Health anything.
Representative Schultz.
So do we know how much it costs in terms of staff time? Because I can imagine this taking incredible amounts of time and staff to look through the claims data to identify these
I will not deny that. It took Stefan Gildemaster and those folks that did a tremendous job with that, but it does take time, absolutely. You have to say reducing waste is essential and really important, and it's going to take time. That's right.
One more question.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why are we only limiting this to medical assistance or Medicaid? I mean, is this done in the private, on the private side?
It is done. State governments obviously have jurisdiction over Medicaid. They don't generally have that much over commercial payers. Some commercial payers are doing things like this. By the way, Minnesota Blue Cross Blue Shield is using these tools, and you can ask them, very happy with them. Okay? But some other states, to answer your question, will align. Texas does this, public payers. So not just Medicaid, but also the state employee benefits program, the teachers union, university employees. Texas has a public payer version of that, and they're bringing they're dealing with Medicaid to those other public payment programs.
Thank you.
Good question.
All right. Final thoughts, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the conversation. And I look forward to working with you collaboratively to put the patient at the center of our healthcare system.
Thank you, Representative Albright. House File 2115, Representative Albright renews his motion. 2115 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish, welcome to the Health and Human Services Health and Services Finance Committee.
Long day.
Representative Cornish, I will move House File 1260 be held over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have a couple of amendments. We first have the A1 amendment. Is it your intention to move the A1 amendment, Representative Cornish?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like if you would move that for me.
Representative Cornish moves the I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Cornish to the A1 amendment.
Can I defer to my testifier just to briefly just explain what the amendment does, not the bill?
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and explain the amendment A1, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I'm the Director of Business Operations for Blue Ridge County Human Services. The A1 amendment does two things. It establishes an effective date for 90 days after receipt of federal approval. And the continuance of that amendment establishes that the Commissioner of Human Services shall seek federal approval necessary to implement the statutes for post-arrest community-based service coordination.
Discussion, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the testifier knows how long, kind of what the time frame is for that federal approval process.
I am not personally familiar with how long that approval process would take. My assumption is that it would be a matter of months for that to happen.
And Mr. Chair, I guess this is just renewing the point and not at all a criticism of the bill, which seems, or of the amendment, which seems extremely worthy, but just the point that we've been making several times that if we do pursue this route where the department has to come back to us after the federal approval is granted, that would delay this worthy cause by that many more months if they could even seek it in the first place. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Further discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no further discussion to the A1 amendment, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Cornish, I also see that there is an A2 amendment in the packet. Is that your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would you like? All right, I will move the A2 amendment at this time. Representative Cornish, the A2 amendment is before us now.
Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment just says that the counties will be financially responsible for the non-federal share of the medical assistance costs resulting from the implementation of that subdivision.
All right, discussion. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this looks like an unfunded mandate on counties. And with the amendment that we just adopted, which is that it's to be implemented within 90 days of federal approval, counties would not have lead time for their budget to even, you know, their only source of revenue basically is property taxes. They're not going to know when the federal government's going to approve this. Within 90 days, they have to step up and offer case management, care coordination, whatever else is required under this. And it changes our relationship with the counties in terms of asking them to pick up the state share on the Medicaid match. And so I really am concerned that this would put an unfair burden on our counties, and particularly given the implementation time frame, make it they'd have to divert resources from other clientele in order to devote them to this. And I can't support this particular amendment. And is there a reason why you wouldn't follow Representative Cornish, our tradition of having the state pay the state match?
Representative Cornish.
Well, could we answer that after we adopt it in the context of the whole bill? I'm sure we can answer that, but we're usually adopting amendments in the shape they want it, and up to you. We can adjust and then jump back to the main crux of the bill. But.
I'll usually take amendments one at a time.
Okay.
Representative Loeffler, you have another question? I know you don't support the amendment.
That's right, Mr. Chair. I just I think because Mr. Cornish is Representative Cornish is not on our committee, I just wanted to make sure that he understood it is a precedent that we don't normally put on counties the burden of the state match.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm kind of thinking along the same lines, Representative Cornish. I've been well trained by my county to always ask whether the counties are supportive of this. Maybe that's the question to ask here. Are the counties supportive of the amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, these two folks are from the county, and they will answer the question there. And before they begin, is it all right if I distribute treats?
Yes.
This is the deer sausage.
The answer to that question is always yes.
This is a deer sausage from a deer that I shot last year. So
the buck shot in there.
And it's fresh. It's not treated or burned or bent at the bottom of the can.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Cassidy. While Representative Cornish is doing that, maybe Mr. Clausen could address the question.
All right. Representative Loeffler is distributing the venison. We're always looking for some more bucks around here, so thank you, Representative Cornish.
That's what it was.
We're looking for more dough. That's good. Very good, Representative Liebling. All right, please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Phil Klaus. I'm Director of Human Services in Blue Earth County. Yes, I think an important distinction here is that this is an absolutely voluntary addition to what we currently have in our service set. We have a continuum of care that does not allow us to provide any resources up front in our services that we provide to this population in our communities. And so this is voluntary on several levels. First of all, counties would totally be able to decide if they opt in or opt out at any point. Law enforcement really are the ones that hold the decision-making authority. We keep that in their hands the whole time. And then the individual also has a voluntary option in this. So there's really three levels of voluntary approach. And so any county that would want to join in, we're trying to have that be the case. And we have had many counties show interest in this change to our service continuum. But no county would be forced to provide these ancillary services as the representative indicated.
Voluntary. All right, Representative Wofford.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see the words voluntary anywhere in the underlying bill and the direction to ask for a federal waiver. And I do see in the amendment before us that counties shall be financially responsible. It doesn't say counties who volunteer to participate in this may volunteer to provide funds to match the federal funds. And so as far as I can see, there's nothing in the bill or the amendments before us that are voluntary.
Mr. Clausen?
Mr. Chair and representative committee members, I think we can easily make those language changes. That is our intent, and we certainly did not mean to misrepresent that in any form or fashion. Certainly those participating was the intent of the language on the amendment, that those counties participating would take on that responsibility to take on that state share.
Thank you, Mr. Clausen. Representative Considine has a question.
Representative Cornish, would you be willing to entertain a verbal amendment to add the word voluntary?
Whatever our council would come up with, or maybe research would come up with a better, or if you wanted to work on it while we held it over, it's up to you, Mr. Chair.
The bill is not going to be moving to another committee. It will be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, and we will be looking at it between here and there. So I think there's, if that's the legislative intent from the authors and from the advocates, we would certainly take that under advisement. I think that's certainly the will of the committee, and we would certainly want to take that, if it were to move forward, incorporate that change.
But you need a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
I wasn't able to give could I get my introduction now? We're done with the amendments, or are we
We haven't adopted it yet.
Oh, okay.
We're going to put it on. All those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Cornish, to your bill as amended.
Well, first of all, I apologize for the procedure there, because in our committee we put the amendments on first and we adopt them and talk about them. I didn't realize it was different here, so sorry about that. But the House File 1260, this bill is expands an already approved medical assistance program called InReach, or they call it Yellow Line. And this allows these folks to go into a jail setting, in the pre-jail setting, and try to sort out people that shouldn't be there. And like they do in the emergency departments, as you know, some of the people, as representatives here can tell, Representative Considine and Grunhagen, who's been in the jail ministry, can tell that a lot of the people that end up in jail, or many of them, shouldn't be there. And just a real quick story, when I was a jailer in Mankato, a person came in named Dale, and I won't give his full name, even though I remember full, middle, and last name. And he came in bouncing off the wall and really in bad shape. There was a multitude of signals that we should have seen. He was booked into jail, and he had come from prison, and he was out on parole, and he got picked up for DWI, so he knew he was going back into prison. So it was already bad. Well, that morning I served him breakfast, and along with his breakfast I served him divorce papers. and legal divorce papers, and then we should have caught the signals what was going on. But about an hour later, one of the inmates came running up that was working inside helping me, and he said, Dale is hanging by his neck. And we went in there, and he was dead. Fell asleep on the floor, hanging by his neck from a sheet. And the reason I tell you that graphic story, that many cases like this of people end up in jail, and they shouldn't have been there, and it comes to a very bad ending. And this program, the Yellow Line program, would help sort those few individuals out and put them in the atmosphere where they are best treated and avoid something like that happening. And these folks could explain the context of the bill.
All right. Just to the underlying context of the bill, that'd be great, Mr. Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We actually have a Yellow Line in our jail right before the door when you enter the jail facility, when you're booked into jail. The area before the Yellow Line, we think, is the key to our project. Trying to negotiate both with law enforcement, the individual, and the services available where our interests come in from human services is we really feel we have a role to play here. We feel like we can offer some support to prevent some tragedies from happening. We believe that when people are booked into the jail, some of them, certainly not all of them, that can make things worse. And so we're trying to sort out in a more sophisticated manner who those people really are. We do believe that this body expects us to innovate at the local level. DHS and obviously our elected officials, a couple of them that are in the room right now, have been very supportive of us trying to innovate. And what we're on the hook for from DHS in some seed money and trying to get this all going is replicability and a sense of sustainability. Those are obviously keywords that are talked about a lot before all of you, but we do feel like this piece of what our project is about is part of a foundation. It is not an ideal foundation. We wish it could be a federal, state, and local partnership with money and resources. We do feel that with what we're facing as a state right now, fiscally, that we have to look at reality and say we want to start somewhere. And I think the alternative might be to be told no. And we'd rather be told yes and try to establish something and show that we can do something that fully matters at our local level. And I do think that ripples to benefit the state and even the federal government, as everyone has a stake in our resources. So those are the key components. I believe in your materials. You do have a handout that looks like this. It should be the first slide. And in a very simple way, it is meant to provide you a picture of what we're really talking about. My colleague will talk about one other picture slide that will show you this in a nutshell. We have a 30-some page packet that we present to our community and to the state that we're starting to share with people and trying to refine our product. But in simple terms, you'll see that on the left-hand column, law enforcement currently really have those three options: jail, taking someone to the hospital, taking them to detox. What we're buying is that next box, a chance for stability, assessment, and triage, a chance to really buy a little bit of time. In this case, it's usually a couple of hours to consider the decisions that are going to be made for booking into jail or alternative resources. That is on a case-by-case basis, and by all means, we meant to convey a very voluntary program in every means of those words. You'll see our addition then, in addition to jail, detox, and hospital, the diversion options, and some of those examples to the right-hand column of the future options that we want to build, and we want law enforcement to be able to have a bigger menu, more sophisticated menu, to create other options to trying to find a solution for individuals that are cost-effective and also assure public safety. So that's really my piece of testimony, and if Chair and members are willing, I'd like to hand it off to my colleague.
Mr. Chair, did you want us to cut the are you running short of time? Did you want us to cut a little short in testimony, or did you want to continue on for a couple of minutes?
Well, if Ms. Youngerberg could kind of describe it, and I think what might be helpful for people is just to get, this is really helpful in terms of to kind of walk through what the proposed kind of a shift would be, just kind of how this would actually operate, not why it's good or why you're doing it, but just how it works in a real functional way, just very quickly, I think would probably be the best use of the committee time.
Sure. I can absolutely do that. If you flip over your page, you'll see a chart that looks like this. And this shows you the more mechanical side of what happens. And so the blue areas is the responsibility of law enforcement. When a person is brought into pre-booking, we would do a screening, negotiate with law enforcement about possible alternatives, and if that does exist, then it would be up to law enforcement to make the decision on if they would like to do a diversion or not. It would also be voluntary if the person wanted to. So if either the person or law enforcement does not want to pursue a diversion, the person then still does go into jail. The yellow part is the key part, and that is really under the purview of human services and service providers within our community. And this bill allows for up to 60 days of community-based care coordination for the individual who's diverted into the community to assure that they are following the plan that they agreed upon at the time of diversion. The community-based coordinator who would be managing the 60 days of follow-up care would then report back to law enforcement and let them know if the person did succeed or not in that plan. And so the federal payment piece of this is new. This is the actual service. What that federal piece would pay for is not the area in blue, so not what happens in pre-booking, but what happens in those follow-up days after the fact. And that is something brand new that does not currently exist at this time. It essentially moves the services that the person may receive after they have been incarcerated and released from jail to up to the point of time at which they would be diverted. The original form of this bill showed a much higher fiscal note when it showed the state and the federal share on it, but given the budgetary pressures that we're all facing, those negotiations have come into play where counties would assume the state's share of the medical assistance cost. And so in light of the amendment, a new fiscal note, I understand, is being drafted and should be nominal for systems changes, so limited just to those systems changes that are necessary to take care of those payment pieces. Thank you. I'll stand for any other questions.
Thank you. We have Representative Liebling and Considine on the list, and Ms. Youngerberg, just to be clear on that cost, that would be a county cost, and is that the state share of costs, or is that the entire cost?
It is the state share of the cost.
So this would then anticipate federal costs that would be added on that side,
yes,
that are not shown in the fiscal note or what we have before us. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really like this idea. I think it's good, it's creative, and it probably would help a lot of folks. And I do think it's voluntary the way it's drafted, because it just has medical assistance covering something isn't covering now that doesn't force anybody to create a program or use it. But one of the things, though, I just wanted to comment, in the language of the bill, of course, it talks about this applies for who's eligible for this, I think it is, who this would be covered for, and it says it's an individual who does not require the security of a public detention facility. And so, unfortunately, I think, Representative Cornish, while I think your motivation here is really great, the story you told, I'm not sure that guy would have qualified under this program, because you said he came out of a correctional institution, he got arrested for a DUI, and, you know, that man needed intervention, no question about it. That is a very sad story, and unfortunately it probably happens a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't look like somebody who actually would have been eligible under the bill. So, you know, that I just kind of want to flag that, because I think that, you know, this is a great thing. If we can keep some people out of jail who don't belong there, that's just a win-win. But we also shouldn't forget that a lot of people who actually are in there and that can't go through this program really need some services too. So I just kind of wanted to make sure we keep that clear. Thanks.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I went through the orientation and they... Did you actually paint a yellow line then?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. At that time, they really didn't have a yellow line. This is the most exciting thing in jails in 50 years. $1,000. It is a tremendous program, and quite frankly, I'm incredibly proud that Blue Ridge County is stepping up and doing this. In the entire time I was there working in the jail, my single biggest frustration for over 20 years was having people brought into jail that we had no services for. It wasn't doing them any good. The jailers hated it. They weren't trained. This is a fantastic program. Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Considine that it's really exciting. I wanted to, I guess I was trying to understand in the structure of this that right now there is a community-based coordinator who does some screening, but just as the services, they're not available. I'm seeing nodding from the testifiers. And so the, and I guess what I'm wondering then is this being done in other counties, other communities at all, or is this just in Blue Earth?
Mr. Clauston or Ms. Youngerberg?
Part of our due diligence in undertaking something like this has been to do a wide search. And while there are many practices and programs across the state and nation that address other parts of our system of care and continuum of care, we have not found anything specifically like this. So while there are crisis intervention training, there's co-responder models, there are many, many pretrial models, we have not discovered any that are fitting this exact model, which was exciting to us that our data and our pilots have shown that this could be quite effective.
So, Mr. Chair, one of the reasons that I ask is that it's disappointing to me that we would be expecting counties to cover it, and I understood what you're saying about fiscal, although also there's a pretty sizable surplus. This seems like this would be the time. I guess I'm hopeful that this can serve as a bit of a pilot project, and so I'm just wondering, are you collecting data, or do you plan to be, to kind of show the savings that I'm sure accruing from this that you could then share with the other 86 counties and with the state?
Mr. Clauston.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative, thank you for the question. Yes, we definitely are collecting data all the way through, very specific data, how long it takes for law enforcement to get in and out, how long it takes us to do screens. We're getting into the community now. That is the new part that we are trying to find funding for. We are definitely trying to set up a foundation, and we think that things on that foundation will shift over time. We want to be smarter about this practice into the future. We are doing a strong interface with the mobile crisis response teams that are in all of our communities. I think they're underdeveloped at this point, and we need to really have a marriage with them so that we practice smart with law enforcement, mobile response, and human services. All of those are the evolutionary kind of quality that your question kind of indicates. And, yeah, I think we do have a ways to go, and actually I hope the funding continues to prove itself, so it's a good investment. Right now, we're willing to put ourselves out on the limb and prove it.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, final point is I agree with Representative Liebling. I really want to highlight that point about somebody who doesn't require the security of a public detention facility, because generally speaking, when an officer brings somebody to a jail, they do believe that they need the security of the facility, at least at that moment. And so I guess I might just flag that for you to keep an eye on, because I'm not sure if that's the test, that may well be pretty high. Then again, not encompassing the individual that the Chair Cornish referenced. So,
Mr. Chair.
Just one last question.
Yes,
I had for just the, if this would require a new building or physical expansion at sites, would that be covered with a bonding request for the state, or how would the construction cost be handled?
Well, there clearly is. There's some bonding activity right now around that very issue, so there's a number of dovetails, and even sitting in on this session, we heard other projects that also could dovetail with this. So my answer would be briefly yes. I think it could go to bonding. And for us, it's a public-private partnership in our community where we have a crisis center, and we have stability beds that we're buying from a private vendor.
So it's not necessarily on campus. It could be a
Correct.
Remote site as well.
Either
and
or.
Probably a bonding request for the construction for the facility itself.
Yes, that could be a possibility. I know some communities are looking at that model.
All right. Appreciate that, Mr. Clauston, and thank you. And to the bill author, I just have to let everybody know that this was not my favorite bill. Just because I looked at it and I said, oh, look at this. Here's another layer of Medicaid spending. at the local level. We're going to be pushing these costs off to somebody else, and it's more spending. And as I said to Representative Cornish, I'm always open to new information because I'm frequently wrong. So anything you can do to convince me, wrapping up here, Representative Cornish.
I'll work on you on the floor.
Work you over.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for coming in today, Representative Cornish. Always good to see you. Appreciate that. Appreciate the testifiers. With that, House File 1260, as amended, is held over for possible inclusion. Finally, today we have House File 1553, Representative Quam. And Representative Quam, I will move House File 1553 be held over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Quam, I also see that there is an A1 amendment in the packet. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Quam, to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That's just a slight technical correction, fixing something that happened when an earlier amendment went on.
All right. Questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Quam, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I apologize. I haven't killed anything lately, so I don't have any treats to disperse amongst you. And frankly, the non-emergency medical transport area is an area where it's difficult enough to decide when it's soup, but when you have a committee deciding of cooks, it takes a little bit longer. So this is a little bit of incremental improvement on the area, and frankly, if it isn't coming forward, it hasn't been agreed upon by everybody, their brother, their sister, and their cousin. And I will have the testifier mention some of the brief specifics on what this bill does.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McKelton on behalf of the Ambulance Association and R80, the rural providers. A couple of things that we worked with the committee and met a few times with them on. Well, there's some managed care language in here about applicability that was approved by the committee and came forward by the Department of Human Services. The RUCA language is the Rural Urban and Commuter Adjustment, and that's a tool that we use in rural Minnesota to beef up some of the mileage patients to keep what few rural providers we have yet in operation. And I see there's a fiscal note on that today. And then also, I know we talked about this in policy, the proration piece. What's happening is this doesn't affect, I believe when I looked at the fiscal note, it was 0.26% of the entire population of non-emergency transportation. And what that is when a company picks up multiple patients, they step down some of the rates for each patient, and it's kind of cumbersome for the counties, providers, and even some of the managed care plans to utilize that, and some of the transportation brokers that are used by the counties to manage that. So this proposed, I believe, is about $68,000 to remove proration from statute for the providers. And then it was just stripping and clarifying some older language around non-emergency medical transportation that we had in the previous bill.
All right. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify to this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll close that off, open it up to member questions. Representative Liebling.
So, thanks, Mr. Chair. Where are we with the amendments here? Did we adopt one of them? And I think there are a couple more.
The A1 amendment, I believe, was the one that we adopted. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So.
And Representative Quam can address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Basically, one of the amendments was came forward from the agency on a date change, and that was pulled back because it wasn't needed. Two of the other amendments were to allow for some discussion on a component and let the committee understand some of that discussion. Most of the discussion, battle, however you want to discuss it, happens behind closed doors, and you only see it after everybody has agreed to it. I thought it might be useful to allow the committee to see some of that discussion so they could understand the forces that go behind and why we have such slow, incremental motion, progress on this, instead of what we'd normally see. However, because of the brevity of the time allowed and the thought that we'll continue to work on it offline, those amendments were brought forward to be discussed and debated here.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I just noticed that if you're going to change the advisory committee, that perhaps it would send the bill to GovOps or something. But thank you. I'm glad we're not. And I, you know, as somebody who worked closely with Representative Norton, who was kind of our guru on this, I understand that it's a very painful process, but I think it's a useful one. And I'm glad that those discussions are being had in that group, kind of not here using committee time. And thank you for working on that.
All right, further discussion. All right, seeing no further discussion, final thoughts, Representative Kwan.
It's good. Go.
All right. With that, our House file. What is it? 1553. House File 1553, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. And members, that concludes our agenda for today. And we. Oh, I'm sorry. Is there a question on another bill? No? No? Okay. Oh, okay. It would help. We can just outline the schedule for next week. Monday, March 27th, we're going to release the spreadsheet and delete all amendment by noon. An email will be sent out to the listserv when we're posted. Tuesday, we're going to take public testimony, so that'll be the day to sign up for public testimony. The amendment deadline is 5. Wednesday, we will do markup. So the committee markup will meet. And then you might want to block out Wednesday evening for markup if we need to come back. So that's just a quick sketch of where we'll be for next week.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, could you repeat again for committee members the amendment deadline?
The amendment deadline is 5 p.m. on Tuesday for Wednesday markup. So you got all day Tuesday. You'll have it on Monday. And then have Tuesday all day for amendments. If there's any questions or problems or if anything comes up, just send an email to Ms. Iverson.
All right.
Okie doke. Thank you. We are adjourned.